Welcome to Really You, a podcast about wearing your voice well, brought to you by Reitmans. I'm your host, Chris Bergeron. Today, I'm speaking with Arianna Loren. Arianna is a pioneering beauty maven. A daughter of the Cowichan tribe, she grew up on the Coast Salish territory near Vancouver. She is deeply inspired by her culture. Her greater mission is to connect today's youth with the natural world.
Hey there, Arianna.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you've designed a t-shirt for us, for Reitmans, for this campaign. And it'd be wonderful if you could tell us the story behind it, the symbolism of it.
Well, I wanted to kind of incorporate a few different elements of my lifestyle and who I am as, I guess, a plant medicine-based business and as a person. And I actually took inspiration from a tattoo that I already have on my arm. And this is a traditional tattoo style, which is a hand holding flowers. And so I did the same thing for my design. I kind of took almost like direct inspiration from my tattoo. And instead it's holding Nootka roses and cedar, which are traditional plants from British Columbia. And those are plants that I have been... you grow up learning about and knowing about, but you also incorporate it into our medicines, and I've used it in my skincare. So it's, I wanted to use those elements, but also incorporate the tattoo, my respect for tattoos, and then, yeah, something a little bit more edgy and fun.
And tell me just a little bit about the cause that is attached to the t-shirt.
Yeah. Well. So I chose Urban Native Youth Association in Vancouver. It's also known as ANYA. And ANYA is a community center, for what I know it to be, is a community center for Native youth transitioning and just kind of figuring out life in Vancouver. And it's, I think, located in the downtown east side. I've been there before to do workshops with the youth on traditional plants, and I saw how powerful those workshops were and how important it is to teach the youth about traditional plant medicine, especially as a Native youth in BC, and to teach them how to engage with what comes from Mother Earth. And the reason why I chose to do the hand-holding the flowers is also like me passing on medicine to the youth so they can bring it forward, just how my elders did with me and in my community. So they're teaching me how to be a plant-based person and to share the medicines, and I want the youth to carry that forward as well. So
it's interesting because you grew up in Vancouver, but also in your community and in the Cowichan tribes, First mm-hmm. Nation. So how did these two different realities shape you and your voice and the way you express yourself in the world?
I had a really tough but humbling upbringing in Vancouver Island, in Cowichan tribes and in my small town, with my grandma, with my sisters. And those were really good memories, and it's a really beautiful place, but there's not a lot of resources. So my family had me move to live with other family in the city in Vancouver so I can get a good education and have opportunities for my future. And I can see why my family did that, because although I left my community and I left my tribe, in Vancouver, there's Squamish Nation, which is a relative of my tribe. They're like sisters, mm-hmm. really closely related. And so I got to move with family there and get just as deeply rooted in my culture as I would have if I stayed in BC, or stayed in, on the island, rather. And I'm lucky to have the contrast of a small town in a big city, a metropolitan city, and the opportunities that were in both places. And so I've really kind of cherry-picked the best of both worlds and have just been really grateful and mindful of where I come from, because not every kid gets to leave Vancouver Island and gets to leave my tribe to see the bigger and better, if that's what you want to call it. But I got that opportunity and just been, yeah, blessed.
And how did you find that calling for skincare? Because it is I guess also that too is a mix of both the urban experience and your origins as well.
So I went to school for holistic wellness. I wanted to be a life coach. And when I got through my program, I decided I didn't really care to sit in a room and ask people about their problems so much as just offering like a remedy that anybody could just kind of pick at their own will, whereas like sitting in a room and coaching somebody is very personal. My skincare is personal, but it's also when that person goes and chooses it, that they welcome it into their life on their own terms. So I wanted to do something like that. I also was super inspired by just the non-GMOs, like how I was learning about, you know, the impact of Monsanto and sulfates and phthalates and all these awful ingredients in everything that we put in our body and on our body. And I was like, well, I could do it, but better. And I'll teach myself how to do it. And I'll teach myself how to incorporate my traditional plants and my traditional teachings and my ancestral medicines. And it just kind of sprung out of nowhere. Like, it was kind of a dream that, like, came to me, and the next day it was a product. And next month will be 4 years in the business.
Well, congratulations.
And snowballed.
It's like you're giving yourself added responsibilities. Mm-hmm. If you know, we compare you to other people who work in the cosmetics industry.
Yeah.
Because you've described yourself as a plant gatherer,
yes,
apothecary maker, workshop facilitator, you're all small business owner. Mm-hmm. You're all of these things. You have to be many women at once.
I do, and I actually really appreciate that there's that dynamic, and I'm not just one of those people and just only that. I wanted to be able to, again, serve everybody and serve people in a way that's wholesome, but also as a teaching opportunity. And I just wanted to be myself, and I never wanted to work for somebody else and feel stifled by the 9-to-5 or the requirements of what needs to be on my resume. It's like, I'll create my own lifestyle, my own lifestyle products, and my own way of teaching everyone about what that is and what's good about it.
Which is easy to say, but very difficult to do. How did you find the strength to actually say, you know, this is, I'm gonna go on my own and do this and spread the word of my culture through it?
I had a really good support system when I wanted to start this business. I was living in a small community in Washington called Swinomish, and it's a really tiny tribe in North Washington. And I was living with my uncle, who is a really, really strong, powerful, and beautiful elder who just was so supportive, and my partner at the time, who was also just keen on making sure that anything I wanted to do came into fruition. So I had this incredible support system, a community that was ready to raise me up, and then I also came from a nation of people who didn't see representation in skincare or in cosmetics or in different places that my products are now sitting. So it was just easy for my people and my communities and my friends and family to just jump on board and say, like, go for it. Like, don't worry about the money. Don't worry about the rent or whatever. Just do what you need to do to get to where you need to get.
So is there a difference between the way, you know, people like me, settlers, I guess, mm-hmm. and people from your tribe see the product, interact with the product, or what is that relationship like?
There's always going to be a different perspective from the different groups of people throughout the world based on just background and what their knowledge is on Indigenous people or First Nations people in Canada. Mm-hmm. And so when people were approaching my products for the first time that were settlers or non-Indigenous people, they had no idea that I was a Native brand until they saw my face. Mm-hmm. Because my logo, I made sure was really approachable, very simple, very clean, and wasn't a big Indigenous design that would right off the bat be like, oh, that's a Native company. Because mm-hmm. I didn't want people to categorize me or put me into a small, you know, a little box and say that's what she has to stick to. I wanted to be approachable by everybody. And so once I got, you know, through my creating my own branding and everything like that, I realized I had a really strong, I don't even know how to reach, because
right.
Everyone felt like it was safe for them to try it. And so there is traditional plants in there. There is ancestral wisdom in those products. And I do wildcraft harvest the ingredients that go into them. Mm-hmm. But it isn't so Native that people are like, is this cultural appropriation if I try using this? It's absolutely not. It's just a way to engage with my people, to engage with my history and my grandmother's teachings and my people, my own tribe, my nation, my community, the Native people in BC and all over Turtle Island or North America have been really receptive, because they see representation in my products. And then they see that if they use my stuff, you know, my skincare or my candles, that they're supporting a small woman-owned, native-owned business over a corporate company that probably doesn't care about the community that they're currently living in. So
that's almost like an instant support system for your line.
It is. Well. And the non-Indigenous community has been there for me since day one. So it hasn't like I had to convince them. They've just been there. And I'm really blessed with that, too.
You spoke about cultural appropriation, mm-hmm. But you also speak of cultural integrity, which yes. I guess is sort of the antidote
yes.
to cultural appropriation. Maybe you can expand a little bit on that.
Yeah, my integrity, first and foremost, is just driven by what would my elders think and say and do in this situation. Like, what would my grandma or my uncle or my relatives say about what I'm doing with the teachings, with their culture, and with this power that I hold with, you know, having so many people watch and view what I'm doing on a daily basis with my skincare, with my social media platforms and things like that. So I want to respect my elders. I want to make sure that the youth that I'm inspiring, if I am in fact inspiring any of them, and I just want to make sure that what I'm doing is impactful in a good way and that it impacts where we live on Earth right now in a good way. So I try to do things sustainable because that reflects the way that we were sustainable people pre-colonization. Mm. And I try to use plant-based ingredients because we're already consuming so much on a daily basis with other things like our consumption of meat. So I just, again, it's always being mindful of what I'm doing, how I impact everybody around me, and then being mindful of what my elders and the youth would think of me.
I think it's wonderful that you speak about elders. Obviously, it's a huge part of your culture, but mm-hmm. it seems that in today's world, there is a deficit of mentorship. Yeah. Everybody's looking for mentors, especially
yeah.
women.
Yes.
You are lucky in a way to be able to tap into that ancestral knowledge, mm-hmm. the people that came before you, and that it's not necessarily something that you work against, but you work with.
Yeah. And my role models and my mentors and all of those people who have been there for me aren't just men and aren't just women. I've had a yeah. little bit of both. I've had my grandmothers, I've had aunties and uncles, and I've had strong, really strong, good medicine men from different communities bring me in and teach me their ways as well. So it kind of goes all the way around for me. And I'm really grateful because that doesn't happen to everybody.
I find that through Western eyes, we tend to leave the caring world to women.
Mm-hmm.
Women are the caretakers.
Yeah.
And men are something else. I mean, obviously, it's being challenged, but that is the archetype.
Yes.
And I love what you just said last, which mm-hmm. is, you know, your mentors are men, are women.
Mm-hmm.
And what they have in common is that aspect, that kindness, and the fact mm-hmm. that they want to take care of others. Is that what you look for in mentors, generally?
I do. I look for mentors who are open-minded and strong in their convictions, but not too strong where they can't be taught by the youth. And like, I am a youth. I'm only 30 years old. And when I started out in this skincare industry, I had no idea what I was looking for. If I was just looking for somebody to teach me traditional plant medicine, if it was somebody to teach me recipes or business or, you know, just how to navigate the world as a human being, I looked for these just strong individuals who supported me as somebody who would support somebody like me down the line. So I wanted somebody that would take care of me the way I would take care of somebody. So it takes a lot to really kind of think about that in bigger picture. But when I ended up meeting these elders and meeting these teachers and just having access to my own relatives who were open to that, it takes a lot of prayer. It takes a lot of setting your intentions and yeah. asking, you know, the universe, hey, can you please send me somebody who's going to nurture me as me?
Do you see yourself becoming a teacher? You are
yeah.
a teacher.
Yeah, absolutely.
In ways. Who looks to you as an elder, even though you're not?
Oh. I mean,
obviously.
I'm not sure.
A little bit too young for that.
I have younger cousins and I have, you know, my siblings are starting to have children, and there's just been kids that I've worked with. When I started doing my workshops, my former partner and I, we started off saying, you know, 4 to 84. Like, there was no age limit for us to teach. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would prefer to teach kids over 12 and people who were under the age of 80, only because the older you get, the crazier. Like, we would go into retirement communities, and they were wild. Like, they were more to handle than kindergarten classes because they had so many more jokes and, like, just funnier stories and just... They were the best, but yeah, we had 4 to 84. So we were always working with people of all levels on all types of journeys. And it's amazing to watch kids just kind of pick up the smallest little thing from you. And you're like, wow, I really impacted that person. And to teach kids about plants is so important to me. Yeah. So it's important to me because it's important to the world. And I just try to think bigger picture.
How do you keep on learning new plants, new ingredients? Because in skincare, you do have to, I mean, there is a sense of newness that, that has to happen. Also, trends evolve, people's needs evolve through time. So what is that process like for you?
It's continuous. So I never thought I would be an expert in psoriasis or eczema or arthritis or neuropathy or just the simplest things that people have, you know, on a daily basis or need for skincare. I never thought I would have to know anything about that. I was like, I'm going to make some candles, some lotion, and that'd be that. Oh, can you make me something for this? Or, oh, could you make me something for that? And so I was, you know, jumping into full-on research. I'd be picking up books, whether it was written by an indigenous author or written by anybody. And I'd pick up a lot of books, was gifted a lot of books. I mentored and apprenticed under lots of different people in my industry briefly. It's always brief because I only need so much before I can just move on. And that's what keeps me growing so fast is my ability to adapt to my situation. Mm-hmm. So I've lived in Vancouver and Seattle and now Albuquerque. And I follow the trend of where do I need to go right now to learn what's valuable to that place to add it to, you know, my toolkit. And so there's a prophecy in my culture, in I think all of North American indigenous cultures and maybe the whole world, but of this eagle and the condor. And it's when the north and the south come together and unite that the world is going to become whole again. And so my elders were saying, okay, when you bring the northern teachings to the south and you gather the southern teachings and bring them home, then you got something really powerful. So I ended up in Albuquerque, which is a really strange place for somebody from Vancouver Island. It's kind of foreign to me, and it's not that far. It's New Mexico, but it's still south to me, where the plants, the desert, and the lifestyle there is teaching me every day.
Did you connect with the indigenous nations over there?
Yeah, so there's the Tiwa Pueblo, which is in Albuquerque. Around Albuquerque, there's I think there's 19 different pueblos in New Mexico, Albuquerque area, and then there is the Navajo Nation. And the Navajo Nation is 500,000 tribal members. That's a massive nation. So it's really easy to get to know a Navajo because there's so many to connect with. But that's also the reason why I moved south, is because I was invited by Diné people, which is actually the correct term for Navajo. Mm-hmm. So the Diné invited me to live that way. And then once I got there, I started connecting with the different pueblos. And they're so open to teaching me about their medicines, but there's also cultural and social protocol that come with what they reserve. So things are meant for just their own people, and they keep that to themselves. And I have absolutely no issue with that. I don't push and be like, well, why not teach me? Like, I'm not a savior or anything like that. I'm just here to gather some plants and some information, and I'll take what I can get in a good way, and then I'll also offer back. So I've been teaching about northern plants like Devil's Club and cedar and things like that down there. And also gathering, you know, juniper and sage and bringing it back home.
So you're also, I mean, you're an ambassador here in the Canadian market, but also down there, you're bringing it.
Yeah, there's not too many Coast Salish folks in the Southwest. There may be like less than five. So
yeah,
it's just important that we both get to, you know, share each other's culture.
It has to be interesting, though, to be living down south amongst such an organized a group of people, mm-hmm. you know, and like you said, 500,000 people. Mm-hmm. And so then do you find that knowledge, ancestral knowledge, all of that is better documented, more readily available than it would be up here, or?
I think so in a lot of ways, and that might be just a biased opinion, my opinion, but yeah, I think it really is a little bit more a lot more organized. They have a structure that I don't think would work up in the Northwest. We are in Canada. Most of the tribes are governed by the Indian Act, so we have a different way of going about our governance and things like that than they do, the Dene people, Navajo people. But I do think their connection to their language, their land, and their culture is so inspiring. The same way all Indigenous people of North America are inspired by the Maori people of mm-hmm. New Zealand, Aotearoa. So we take a page from their book, and we keep inviting them to our territories up here and because we want to learn. And I think that's just so powerful and beautiful to see, and the cultural exchanges that happen between these different Indigenous communities all over the world. And so I would love to see more Salish people learning from the Dene and more Dene learning from the Salish, and just, you know, more Canadian natives learning from American natives.
Yeah.
Because it's a wide open market for it right now. We're in a good place right now where we need to.
It's interesting that you describe it as a market.
Yeah.
Because these are probably consumers for
you
as well.
They are. And every native has, you know, the right to be a consumer. And we have the right to take over, you know, different parts of the industry, different industries, and all over my country, the U.S., anywhere. We have a voice and we have a place. And I think as like a minority on our traditional territory, it's important that we kind of take some sort of power in that. And it's just so valuable what we have to teach others and how we as Indigenous people approach owning businesses with our ancestral wisdom.
That's it. It is important to refer to you even as a business owner,
mm-hmm.
almost for mostly.
Mm-hmm.
First thing, you're a business owner.
Yeah, and I'm an entrepreneur and I take a lot of pride in that.
Did you have entrepreneurial role models, though, that you had to...
Yes, I did. And they're really, really amazing people. You know, some of them are serial entrepreneurs who've changed their roles many times. But in BC, all of the Indigenous people that I grew up with, you know, admiring the most were entrepreneurs. So the beaters, the weavers, the carvers. And those are, you know, roles that were traditional in my community growing up, you know, and I am growing up in the history. And then growing up, I saw them. You know, there's women who did the beadwork and made beautiful jewelry, and then men who carved the most beautiful plaques and totem poles, and my grandma, who was a weaver, and she knits couch and sweaters. And so growing up with her, I think at 6 or 7 years old, I sold my first scarf.
Mm-hmm.
And so she taught us a, you know, couch and style of knitting, and then brought our scarf to the gallery and sold our scarf for wholesale and gave us the money from it.
Yeah.
I just did my first wholesale contract at like 7, you know, first grade. And now I do that full time. And so it's just always been really a big part of my community, but my world.
But you're pushing the boundaries of tradition, though,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. So you've learned these traditional skills from these small business owners. But it feels that you're setting up a bit of a different kind of business as well, because there is a bit more of a it's more of a hybrid.
Yeah, and it's also a way for me not to exploit where I come from. It's just I simply want to teach everybody about the power behind traditional plants, and that every single human being in the entire world, Indigenous or not, whether you are claimed by the land or the land claims you, every single person in the world comes from plants.
Yeah.
It's not just Indigenous people, just because we're more connected to it because we've, you know, we try to maintain that through history. Every single person comes from that. And I'm just here to kind of wake that up and remind people, whether it's like, you know, a really pretty candle that they might be inspired by or a salve that I make with the traditional plants from where I come from.
Because I guess the risk would be to fall into the cliche almost, in a sense. And that's when tokenism comes in.
Yeah, and I will not let anybody tokenize me. There's no time for it. It's, you know, it's 2020. Things have changed so much since I was a kid when we would, you know, watch Disney movies called Indian in the Cupboard.
Oh, Jesus.
So, yeah, things have changed. And that was a Disney movie. And I loved that movie growing up. But that was, you know, that not that long ago. It wasn't so far back. And so we're in this place now where it's just like you can be very strong and say, I don't want that.
Through your travels, has your definition of the word community changed or evolved in any way?
Yes, it's broadened. I used to think my community was just my family, and then I used to think my family, being a part of my community, was just my tribe. Yeah. And then I found out I belong to a huge nation, and that nation is a part of, you know, this, it just keeps gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And once I decided to move south of the border, I realized we're not different people, we're all the same. There's just a dotted line that kind of divides us. Yeah. Whether people acknowledge that or not. But yeah, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I've been on countless journeys throughout North America, South America. I've been over, you know, overseas. And every time I go anywhere and I start to meet more people, that's more people I add to my community.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to be a part of this global community, you know, just inspire and be a part of this huge movement of people who are just here to take care of the earth. So that's a community I think I'm the most a part of.
Yeah, and so I guess that also impacts your vision of what being authentically you means, because it's the sum of the past and the experiences that you're going through right now. What is being authentic for you?
Authentic is just like, at the end of the day, did I do the best that I could to really make sure that who I am is shining through the skin that I'm in? And, you know, I never exploiting my culture and not exploiting anybody or anything around me. And just at the end of the day, did I feel good about what I did? And do I feel good about going into the next day tomorrow as myself? And so I try to do that and be that way. And I have social media platforms where you could really just highlight real yourself on and a business and all of these things that I could just send out into the world as this shiny, pretty thing. But I want people to see that there is real life struggle behind it. You know, not everything is just presented as it is. And so I always share my story. I share my struggles. I share just little details that I know people need to see to feel validated in. And it's not in a way that's just like self-serving.
But that's interesting, because often when people talk about social media and the prevalence of social media as sharing tools between people, they always look at the dark side of it, which is, you know, it's a little bit fake, the filters, all of that. But they tend to overlook how it's also a way to bond, to connect, to share stories, to create solidarity between people as well. It's interesting that you use it in that way.
I just didn't want to be an influencer the way that Instagram was kind of shaping people, and I didn't want to be an ambassador the way that, you know, these brands ask you to be, and I didn't want to fall into, again, like being tokenized or in a category. So just being myself, I always know that, like, if I'm myself, I'm just going to end up where I hope to end up. And it's like, I love being kind of, what's the word or the term? Like a lone wolf?
Oh, yeah.
Like, I like to lead the pack, but I also like to be on my own. And so authenticity has really helped me kind of just stay that lone wolf. And whether people are following behind me or not, it's because they believe in what I do and they see value in, and they see something in me that they see in themselves.
It must be difficult to be a lone wolf. You've had some struggles, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Starting up the business, if only that.
Yeah.
So let's share some.
Yeah. Well, coming from Duncan, it's actually a really, really small town on Vancouver Island. It has so much going for it and such little support. And my nation itself, the Couchin tribes, it's a big tribe with very little resources that are bringing in revenue for my people. And so I wanted to get away from that. I thought I needed to escape it, but that was like the least of my problems, I think. I always want to go back home to that now and find ways to support my people and to be there. And that's like the biggest struggle. That's my biggest, like, I guess something that I always struggle with, because I always find myself further and further and further away from my tribe, further and further away from my people. And I just know because of the work that I need to do, it's bringing me that far away. So, yeah, I'm on my own, but I'll go to different places and establish a support network and then move on and establish another one. So I might always be on my own, but I still create, again, community where I'm at. Mm-hmm. And it's like a sense of resilience that not that many people around me understand.
So resilience on one side, because you have to find the strength in yourself to keep on exploring and going mm-hmm. further. And at the same time, I guess a bit of a notion of guilt, because you're so far away from the people that you loved.
It's also resilience in knowing that I did this to myself.
Yeah.
And that I choose to do this. I choose to be on this path by myself. I never go about ways where I'm like, well, why am I, well, you know, why me? Why me? It's like, okay, this is happening for a reason. And I do make decisions to get here for a reason. So yeah, that's the resilience in knowing that too.
Would you say that in a sense your life is uncomfortable because of that?
I think life's always going to be uncomfortable. I don't know if anyone's life is comfortable. Mine's, there's times where I'm like, this is cool, but might as well switch it up because I just need to continue to grow and learn. And even school was like uncomfortable for me. So the school of life is just that.
Yeah. So you have to find power in yourself.
Every day.
What's your definition of power?
Oh, God. This is a hard one. Power. When I was taught by my family, they're like, you have to be careful about your power, about the way you go into the world. So it's just your impact and your influence and just how people are going to, I guess, drink you up or, you know, consume you. And mm-hmm. some people could do that with positivity or negativity. And I always try to make sure that I'm filling people up in a good way, in a positive way. And yeah, they were saying in school when I was in learning about how to be a life coach, like, you know, if you wear red it's a power color. So you don't want to wear red with your clients because you don't want them to think you're the most powerful person in the room. You're trying to give them back their power.
Really? People would say that?
Yeah.
You're so young. I can't believe that life coaches would, I mean, God, this must have been 10 years ago.
About 10 years ago. I think it was some cutting edge education at the time, and I wasn't ready for it. And some of it is really archaic and really holistic and like kind of far to one side.
Yeah.
And so that's why I ended up in the industry that I'm in, because I always wanted to just go about helping others on my own terms and not by what this book told them or what Ayurvedic medicine told them or what Reiki energy healing told them. Or crystals or yoga, all these different things that people believe to be holistic. I was like, I think you can indigenize holistic wellness, so I'm going to just go down that path.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all these things that you just mentioned, they're trends.
Yes.
And I could imagine that there would be a trend coming, and it is coming, mm-hmm. Sort of indigenous knowledge in skincare. It's going up. How are you going to deal with that when in a sense you hit the mainstream? Just the fact that we're here talking means that in a way, the mainstream is here.
Yeah, I asked them, like, how did you guys find me? They're like, oh, we found you through Instagram.
Right.
The most trendy thing to be found on is now Instagram.
Exactly.
Like, I didn't submit a resume and I wasn't found through an agent or anything like that. I'm an indigenous person that has been navigating the business world. And as a skincare business that happens to be native, people just jump on that. And I get invited to places that I wouldn't normally get invited to. I've sat down and hosted workshops with companies that have tried to infiltrate my workshop as a way to do product research. Mm-hmm. And these are big corporate companies that are like, you find out after the fact and you're like, I think I should have got them to sign an NDA. But I also believe in spiritual karma. So maybe that's what separates me from those people. It was like, oh, I told them, you know, at the end of my workshop, like, if you steal any of my, you know, ancestral knowledge or the teachings that I'm bringing forward or things that I've conceived and built on my own, if you steal any of that and you go and use that to make a product for your business, good luck, because like the integrity behind that is going to shine through so, so strong. And I laugh about it because I, you know, I remember that day, that specific time, I was like 26 years old. Like, not a lot of 26-year-olds would probably be able to say things like that. But I was like, no, thank you. I don't want to get ripped off.
Well, congratulations for standing up for yourself. Does that mean now you're thinking about things like lawyering up and patents and all of that stuff?
I've completed a business program in New Mexico, and a lot of the mentors in that program are like, do you have a patent? Are your recipes, you know, are you trademarking these? Are you patenting these things? I'm like, no, because I don't own them. And yeah, I might have created something, but that has been created before. My elders were making these things, and their parents and their grandparents and everybody before them were making these things. And so I don't own those teachings or recipes. They're just passed on. Mm-hmm. And for me to trademark that or to patent that would be, again, exploitive, I feel like. So I just don't go down that path, and I just always make sure that people know, please don't steal. Like, it's not nice. Like, shame on you. And hopefully that goes, you know, a long enough way where I don't have to worry about things like that. But as far as being a trendy native business, I'll take advantage of that in the moment. I will get myself into the spaces I need to get in to teach those people when I have the opportunity, because it might not always be there. And right now, to get into that big craft fair market and, you know, in the U.S. is like, there's this huge one. I don't think there's very many natives or any natives that get invited to that.
Right.
So I'm going to be that person. And then I'm going to make sure everyone knows.
Yeah.
Because we need more of it. And again, not to tokenize, and just to make it normal. It should be normal. Not everything should be labeled like, this is an indigenous business or that's a woman-owned business. Things should just be all, you know, normal.
Yeah, well, I like to say tokens are bad, but symbols are good.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I agree, 100%.
So if we fast forward to 10 years and you're running a little beauty empire, well, maybe it's not even an empire, though.
Yeah.
How would you see the future of your business and your craft?
I want to continue to expand organically. I think I've done everything super organically. I haven't had any capital that wasn't my own. I don't owe anybody any money, which is nice. So I just want to keep growing organically. I want to start hiring more Indigenous people to, you know, so I can stop making stuff every day on my own and stop labeling every lip balm that goes out the door. Yeah. But I eventually want to, bring more people on board and have Couts and Made go on to be its own brand that is self-sufficient. And so I can go on to be a serial entrepreneur and maybe open a winery or, start a clothing company or do something else. Like, there's always, as a creative person, there's always something cooking up. And I feel like I haven't even grown up yet, so I feel like I can still say, when I grow up, I want to be this. Because right now, what I have is good, and I want that to continue being good. I don't want to ever get too big and sell out to somebody and be like, well, here's my, million-dollar business. You can have it.
Well, I did
all the hard work, but it's yours now.
We're all rooting for you.
Yeah, thank you.
And so if those that are listening, if you hear a little breathing sound, there's the most adorable little dog right now on your lap, and he's sleeping.
Yes.
What's his name?
Davidson. He's a dachshund I just adopted in the last 6 months or so. But it's my dream dog. I've always wanted a wiener dog since I was born, like since I was a child. And I finally met Davidson, and we are now inseparable.
Well, thanks for the both of you.
Yeah, thank you.
To have come and chat with us.
Yeah, I appreciate
a pleasure
being here.
Thank you.